I'd like to give everyone a very heartfelt and warm welcome to Hyde Park Bible Class. Thank you very much, everyone, for coming along tonight. Now, I'm pretty excited because Dave and I have had a few chats about his research that he's done on a study of David. So, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Marge, and it's wonderful to be with you all tonight. It's been a while. I reckon I last was in this hall doing a Bible class many years ago on Joel, which probably none of you remember, but it's nice to be back with you tonight to share a little bit of what I've gleaned from the life of David. It's a massive undertaking, and I really didn't feel up for doing it until I turned 50, because obviously such a complex character, as James said, with so much detail. I really wanted to try to somewhat live a bit of my life before I tried to understand a man of such complexity and greatness as David. So I hope I can share a little bit of the enjoyment and the passion that I found in studying the life of David. We're going to start, if you want to open your Bibles or your devices, to 1 Samuel 16, because right up front, we learn pieces from every aspect of David's life, and it's exactly the case here with his selection. So 1 Samuel 16, verse 1, we read that the Lord said to Samuel, "I will send you to Jesse the Bethlehemite, for I have provided for myself a king among his sons." And then verse 3, "I will show you what you shall do." He says, "You shall anoint him who I declare to you." So David was handpicked to be king by God. And we might ask ourselves, well, why was that? Well, God gives us the answer, thankfully, and it's there in verse 6, because we read, "When all the sons of Jesse came, Samuel particularly looked at Eliab and thought," it says in the record, "surely the Lord's anointed is before him," before God. But actually, God said to Samuel a really amazing point: "Do not look on his appearance or on the height of his stature, because I have rejected him. For the Lord," and this is a really important point, "the Lord sees not as man sees. Man looks on the outward appearance, but the Lord looks on the heart." And there's volumes of lessons just in those remarkable statements. But the bit that I wanted to choose out of this is something you might have considered before, but maybe not. You see, one chapter before, there's a really, really interesting statement. Samuel said very simple words to Saul in 1 Samuel 15, verse 29, and he just said this: "God is not a man." Have you ever pondered that statement? God is not a man. There's so much in that statement. God is profoundly different, profoundly different. Job says exactly the same thing if you're taking notes. Job 9, verse 32, "God is not a man." Numbers 23, verse 19, "God is not a man." Three times in the Bible, specifically this seemingly obvious statement, "God is not a man." Now, why is it that God is not a man? What is the fundamental difference? Now, this might take you into a bit of a reinterpretation of a classic Bible verse, which is Isaiah 55, verse 7 to around about verse 9. And you would all know it, but let me read it to you in this context. "Let the wicked forsake his way, and the unrighteous man his thoughts. Let him return to the Lord." Why? Because Isaiah says, "that God may have compassion on him, for he will abundantly pardon." What comes next? "For my thoughts are not your thoughts, my ways are not your ways. My thoughts are higher than your thoughts, and my ways are higher than yours. In what way? Does it mean, as we often use that passage, that God is so much more extraordinarily powerful, intelligent, capable? No. The way God defines that I am different to you, my thoughts and my ways are higher, is because I have compassion and I forgive. You are not me. You are prone to doing the exact opposite, which is exactly what later on David absolutely observed because of his lived experience. A lot later, again, famous words, 2 Samuel 24, verse 14. Let us fall into the hands of God, not man. David got it, that with God, there's forgiveness and abundant pardon, whereas with man and women, us as humans, we're often a lot harder, tougher, unforgiving than God himself. That's how he chooses to differentiate himself. That is what he says is his defining quality, which goes all the way back to how he introduces himself in Exodus 34. All those characteristics which are inherently a divine Christian God that we worship. Really important. The other thing that's pretty obvious, I'm sure, to all of us, and it's something we should all say thank God for, is that he doesn't look on the outward appearance. I'm sure you notice that. You think of it. We, on one hand, attribute righteousness to people based on what they look like, and on the other hand, equally write people off based on what they look like. And on so many occasions, probably almost invariably, are horribly wrong. Because the one we might impute righteousness to based on how they look, Jesus tells us, hey, they might be clean cups and saucers, very clean white tombs, but inside full of dead men bones. And these people that we might write off based on their outward appearance, inside might be a broken and contrite heart that God, in fact, wants to dwell with. So God fundamentally differs from us in that regard as well. And thank God for that, that he doesn't judge based on the external. He doesn't, as Dennis Gillett so often would write, he doesn't judge on the occasional. He's not deterred by the occasional setback. He's not overly impressed by any external show of piety or righteousness. And again, thank God for that. It really is a beautiful thing. And for David, as Barge prayed, we know the incredibly well-known words, which come a bit earlier than this, when Saul is informed that God will seek out a man to be king who's a man after his own heart. And I love that concept too. And I am sure, maybe for our younger ones, you don't fully appreciate that as much as some of us who have lived a little bit, but it's very, very, very heartening that God looks at the essence of who we are, the kernel of who we are, the core of who we are, right? Take David. You could have said, who was David? Oh, adulterer, murderer. But the core, the essence, the desire, the intent, the motivation, the character and quality of David was a heart that beat in time with God's. And that's awesome. Because as Barge said, every single one of us will fail. And regularly fail. But what is the core? What's the essence? I can't see that in you. I can only infer. And you can't see that in me. But thank God that he does see to the real essence of who we are. What makes us up? What makes us tick? And with David, his heart ticked in time with God's. Amazing. He was a man of compassion. And we'll see that he did abundantly pardon just as he was by God. So there's a few little lessons from the very start of the life of David. But maybe to bring that home even more to us and to us in our daily life, Jesus picks up some of this in quite powerful ways. Again, if you're making notes, because we'll sort of stay here in Samuel, but these are well-known words as well. John 7, verse 21, "Do not judge by appearances, but with right judgment." So we're commanded not to judge by appearance. It takes a lot of training to do that. Human psychology, it's proven that we form impressions of people in milliseconds, sub a second. It's extraordinary. Harvard just released some new research on how quickly we form views on other people, primarily based on appearance. And Jesus actually uses some pretty extraordinary examples to make this point. For example, on one occasion, it happened to be a Sabbath day, and he healed a man. And he says to the people at that time, "You know, this is crazy." We would put the words that Jesus used in the Greek. "This is crazy. You are ignoring the fact that on this day I have made a man whole, but you're caught up in the ceremonial law, not the moral law, not the issues of the heart, not the issues of life." And again, I think there's a translation of that to us today. How often do we judge someone who might be morally fine with God and Christ, and yet some ceremonial observance in our community, they might not rise to that? And we can infer all sorts of things from that. And Jesus says, don't do that. It's really wrong. Your judgment is wrong. How can you be upset that I've just made a man whole on the Sabbath? Don't put the Sabbath, a ceremonial observance, above the moral obligation to heal someone. 2 Corinthians 10, verse 17, "Do we look on things after the outward appearance?" 2 Corinthians 5, verse 12, "Do we glory in appearance, not in heart?" Are we worried about the impression we make, keeping up appearances? One of the long-running British sitcoms, all about how we appear to others. Is that our focus? And I guess the last verse that I would use in this regard is, again, the words of Jesus. "Beware of practicing your righteousness before other people to be seen by them, for if you do this, you will have no reward of your Father in heaven." That's from the Sermon on the Mount. Very sobering. If our motivation is to make an impression on earth, heaven gives no applause. Zip. It means zip. It's invalidated. It's very sobering. Doing a talk, doing a good work, what we wear, how we speak, what we say, if any of that is designed to carry favor, to win plaudits, it means zero to God. It's corrupted. Invalidated. Confronting words. So with David, it wasn't about his appearance, although we'll see he was a captivating individual. God was choosing based on what he saw, and that's a lovely thing for all of us. Now, we read in verse 11 of 1 Samuel 16 that having passed over all of Jesse's seven sons, Samuel actually says, "Hang on a minute, are all your sons here? Are all of them here? Because God's not chosen any of them, but he sent me here. What's going on?" You can imagine Samuel's a bit perplexed. And Jesse says, "There remains the youngest, but he is keeping the sheep." And I think this is a really interesting reference, really, because Moses was similar. Before Moses was fit to lead the people, he was a shepherd. Before David was fit to lead, he was a shepherd. And In fact, it was Eleanor Roosevelt, the wife of a famous US president, who said a really beautiful thing. She said, people don't care about how much you know until they know how much you care. And I've always absolutely loved that in the context of leadership. Peter learnt the same lesson. Jesus said, feed my sheep, feed my sheep. Peter had to realize that leadership is more about feeding than leading. It's about meeting the needs and caring for people. All great leaders care about the people they lead. And if they don't, those who are following sense that real fast and cease following. So here was David, a shepherd who learned exactly what would credentialize him for kingship. But then we do get a little bit of an insight in verse 12 to his appearance, because it says that David was ruddy and had beautiful eyes and was handsome. So Samuel senses. So maybe he's come from the fresh mountain air. He's run to this beckoning to meet this great prophet, and he's got the sort of blushed cheeks, the rosy glow of the fresh mountain air is probably the first thing that Samuel noticed. But then he's drawn to his eyes, these dazzling, brilliant eyes. When David's drawn, he's often drawn with sort of curly hair and bright blue eyes. Who knows what that is, whether it's true, but often sort of a strawberry blonde might have cheeks that go a little bit red, and then those dazzling blue eyes, which were quite captivating. But then obviously after Samuel's absorbed that, he sort of zooms back out and takes into frame this altogether very handsome young man. The Hebrew is very clear. He was a very good-looking young man. And then verse 13, the Spirit. I often think about this with Old Testament characters, but the Spirit of the Lord rushed on David from that moment on. So from this moment on, the Spirit of God, the power of God worked in David's life, just as it does in us today. Now, a question remains about the early life of David, and that is, who was his mum? Because we actually don't know, but it is a bit of a puzzle. If you're into these sorts of things, you might want to follow this up and have a look at it, because it's quite intriguing. The birth of David, who were his natural siblings, who were his stepbrothers and stepsisters, etc. One view of this is, for example, it's quite notable that when asked to bring all of his sons, Jesse doesn't bring David. And yet he was Jesse's son. One of the views, and please forgive me if you disagree with any of this, I'm just sharing with you some of the views. One of the views is that David was potentially an illegitimate child of Jesse, which is very interesting in terms of what the greater son of David was accused of. Remember, Jesus was accused of being illegitimate. Now, some of the views around that is obviously Jesse's conduct towards his son. Other view on that is simply that he was too young, but bear that in mind. Passages like this, though, potentially could be literal. Otherwise, there's very obvious reasons for them not to be literal and to be interpreted figuratively. But Psalm 51, verse 5, David says, I was brought forth in iniquity. In sin did my mother conceive me. Interesting. Similarly, in Psalm 71, verse 6, he says to God, you took me from my mother's womb. God, you took me straight away from my mother's womb. Psalm 22, verse 9, you took me, there it is again, you took me from the womb. You made me trust you at my mother's breast. On you was I cast from my birth. Now, that word cast in the Hebrew is interesting. It's the very word of Hagar who cast Ishmael under a bush to die. It's the same word that Pharaoh used for all the Hebrew boys that they'd be cast into the river. So some would suggest, some commentators, that David was potentially rejected at birth because of this somewhat scandalous birth that was perhaps illegitimate. Another view is that when you look at the genealogy and you look at David's two sisters, which we know were Abigail and Zeruiah, Abigail's dad was not Jesse. Abigail's dad, it's very clearly recorded, was a fellow by the name of Nahash, right? And so potentially Abigail's father, Nahash, died and the mother married Jesse, potentially after this illegitimate relationship with Jesse, which clearly then means that potentially David and Abigail shared the same birth mother. Now, we know also from that exact passage, 2 Samuel 17, verse 25, that Amasa, who was Abigail's son, shares a special relationship with David, because later on in 2 Samuel 19, verse 13, David says of Amasa, "Are you not bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh?" Whereas of all the sons of Zeruiah, he says, "What have I to do with you, you sons of Zeruiah?" As if they are totally separate. So Zeruiah, he wasn't a sort of natural blood sibling of, but maybe Abigail, yes. Hence that special relationship with Amasa. You have a look into it yourself. You cannot be conclusive. I've tried for quite some time to get to. By the way, in Jewish tradition, everything I've said is borne out in Jewish tradition. So if you look at Jewish custom and tradition, absolutely that is what they believe, that David was an illegitimate child, brother of Abigail, and therefore had the same birth mother separate to Zeruiah. Now, Jewish tradition, can we rely on that? No, we rely on the Bible. The Bible doesn't tell us emphatically, but it is worth pondering. And if you follow that, it sort of comes up quite a bit in David's life, but we won't reference that again. That's for you if you want to look at it. Now, Barge alluded to a little bit of this in his opening remarks. Have a look at verse 16. We get a feel for the remarkable man and young man at this time that David was, because we know that Saul, and that's a study in itself, suffered extreme mental ill health. It's a study in mental health. If you wanted an extraordinary study in mental health, you would look at the life of Saul. And in verse 16, they seek out one to play the lyre, who was skilled in playing the lyre or the harp. And one of the young men or servants says, verse 16, "I have seen a son of Jesse the Bethlehemite who," look at this, "is skillful in playing, a man of valor, a man of war, prudent in speech, a man of good presence, and the Lord is with him." That's an extraordinary rap, huge rap. So by now, David was no ordinary shepherd boy. He's a prodigiously talented musician. He's a powerful athlete. He's a fighting machine. He's a deep intellect, and he's a deeply handsome man. We might say the package, a complete package. He was everything, an extraordinary individual. The sort of term in psychology would be a polymath. He was as erudite as he was a man of valor. He was an athlete, a creative, a composer, an orator. In fact, he became renowned all the way forward. In Amos 6 verse 5, it says that there were those who, like David, invented instruments. So David didn't just play instruments, he invented them. In fact, all the way forward in Nehemiah chapter 12, verse 36, it says they celebrated with the instruments of David. So he didn't just play music, he made instruments. Amazing. Amazing individual. And look at some of these terms. I'm going to unpack them a little bit because they come up again. Where it says that he was prudent, the Hebrew word means to separate. You might think from that, what that's really saying, he was a man of sound judgment, discernment between right and wrong, good and evil. He distinguished between the two. He was a man in control of his thoughts. That's essentially what that word means. Whereas when it says prudent in speech, the word speech literally means to arrange. He was this powerful orator. We might think of, in more modern times, a Barack Obama for those a bit older, a John F. Kennedy, just an incredible way with words. That's what it's saying about David. And then look at the impact. Verse 21, he was a magnetic figure. He entered Saul's service and Saul loved him greatly. He became his armor bearer and Saul says off to Jesse, "Let David remain in my service, for he has found favor in my sight." And where it says that Saul loved him greatly, it's a very strong word in the Hebrew. The Hebrew is probably best rendered vehemently, passionately. Saul passionately loved David at this point. That passion changed a little bit, but you get this sense of how compelling a figure what David was, an amazing young man. Now we come to the remarkable incident of David and Goliath. And I'll have to tone my voice down. I had a bit of a scary moment. I was in Korea and I had to speak at the APEC summit. And the night before, my voice completely died. I had nothing. And so that was a bit of a scary moment. But it came back for long enough to do my speech. And then for the rest of that day, I couldn't speak either. So that wasn't very good. So I'm still suffering a tad from that. Let's have a look then in the next chapter at this remarkable incident. And there's so many layers to the story of David and Goliath. We won't in this study spiritualize it, but you can. And there's lots of types and meanings, but we're going to really unpack the story and see what a remarkable victory this was for the Israelites. Now, the first thing to notice is that this took place in a very famous battle location. In verse 1, it says it was in Ephesh Damon. Now, Ephesh Damon means the boundary of blood drops. So there's a lot of blood that's been spilt here. It was an iconic battle location. And when you think of David and Goliath, we often have kiddies' storybook versions that it's often set on a plain. That's in fact very wrong because it's in the Valley of Elah in this boundary of blood drops. So boundaries. And if you have a look at verse 3, it says there was a valley between them. The Hebrew word is a gorge between them. So quite a deep gorge, and along the bottom of that was the brook that went along this gorge. And the battle adversaries were arrayed on each side, the Philistines on the mountain on one side and the children of Israel on the mountain on the other side, both of them there. And then for 40 days, verse 16, we read, for 40 days, Goliath came forward and look at this, took his stand, morning and evening. So sin, which is clearly what Goliath epitomized, took its stand and defied the saints or the children of Israel. Verse 4, if you look back, he's described as the champion of the Philistines. Now, what's the word champion? Now, because it's an interesting word, the word champion is actually a duology. It's the dual form of the very word used to describe David as a prudent man. And remember we said prudent men to separate. So this is talking about double separation. What it's saying is Goliath was a polarizing figure. He stood there and it was very clear he stood for that, they stood for that, separated by a gorge. He's down in that gorge with his booming voice echoing up to all that could hear, this dynamic, polarizing figure, an absolute giant of a man. You know, when you stand next to someone like Das, you think, my goodness me, he's a giant, right? Well, lots has been made of how tall was Goliath, but essentially the most commonly accepted view of a cubit is that it was measured from, it's essentially the forearm from the tip of the elbow to the top of the longest finger, whatever that one's called, right? And for most people, that's around about 50 centimetres. Now, that puts Goliath at around about 10 foot tall. So that's very tall. I think that's the height of a basketball ring, isn't it? 10 foot tall. So very, very tall. Like, Das, you must be 6'6 or something, 6'5. So, you know, a very, very tall person. And his armour, the best estimates or consensus is that just his armour, like his coat of armour, weighed about 70 kilograms. We know that his spear or javelin, that it was likened to a weaver's beam, if you've seen a weaver, this huge thing, and just the head of it, weighed 7 kilograms. Like, that's a lot. If you think about when you go to the shop to buy a bunch of apples, that would be a lot of apples, right? Just the head of the spear. So this huge beast of a man, and he was all dressed in brass. Now, I don't know about you, this my personality, I suppose. You hear, as Chris Irwin used to say, brass stands for flesh, and you go, oh, yeah, well, prove it. Like, maybe you don't think like that, but I do. I'm like, where does that come from? Is it legit? Well, it is legitimate, because if you're taking notes and you've ever wondered, is it true? In Ezekiel 22, and most of these references around brass standing for the flesh or sin are in Ezekiel. Ezekiel 22, verse 19, you have all become dross. The word dross is the exact word for brass. Therefore, I will gather you and burn you in the furnace. So dross is the word for brass, in fact, which it occurs in Ezekiel 22, verse 19. Ezekiel 24, verse 11, set the pot empty upon the coals that it may become hot, and its brass may burn, that its uncleanness may melt. The word uncleanness is the same word, brass, that occur in the same verse. And then last but not least, if we haven't got the point, Ezekiel 16, verse 35, O prostitute, your lust has been poured out. In the King James Version, it says your filthiness has been poured out. That's the word for brass. So I think it's quite clear that brass is a proxy or often used for filthiness, uncleanness. And this giant of a man stood for the filth of the flesh. And we will see that in ways you may not have seen or been aware of. And it's quite, it's very clear this man was a very crass, disgusting individual. Verse 8, for 40 days he stood and shouted to the ranks of Israel, choose a man for yourself and let him come down to me. If he's able to fight with me and kill me, we'll be your servants. But if I kill him, you'll be our servants. I defy you. Give me a man that we may fight together. The reaction, verse 11, when Saul and all Israel heard these words, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. The word dismayed literally means to be prostrate, to fall down. They were rendered completely prostrate, in fear, abject fear. When it says greatly afraid, that's that word vehemently afraid. They were terrified of this giant of a man and his bold, disgusting language. And it's into that cauldron that David doesn't just walk, he runs in. And I love some of this, because have a look in verse 20. Like many other icons in the Bible, people like Daniel, Abraham and others, it says in verse 20, he rose early in the morning and came to the encampment as the host was going out to battle. It's very clear that he must have run, sprinted almost, the whole way, because in verse 17, Jesse tells him, carry the grain and loaves quickly to the camp. The word quickly literally means to rush. And from where from where David was in Bethlehem to the Valley of Elah is 20 kilometres. It's a half marathon. And he got there by dawn, by daybreak. So he absolutely ran that whole distance. And he keeps running. Verse 22, he ran to the ranks and went and greeted his brothers. Verse 48, he ran quickly towards the battle line to meet the Philistines. So this was an incredibly fit, young, ruddy fellow, this rugged, handsome, tough shepherd boy, fearless, running, passionate, a man of industry. And look at him, verse 23, this is really profound. This is the secret. As he talked with his brothers, we read that Goliath came up out of the ranks of the Philistines and spoke the same words as before. And look at this. And David heard him. All the men of Israel, when they saw the man, fled from him and were much afraid. And the men of Israel said to David, have you not seen this man that has come up? Can you see the difference? They saw, David heard. It's really profound, and it's repeated in this record. They saw and they melted away. David heard and he was disgusted. He focused on the hearing. You know what it says there, that the Israelites fled? The word literally means to vanish. And again, when it says much afraid, again, that's this Hebrew word, vehemently, vehemently afraid. They vanished. They literally, like a vapor, it destroyed them to nothing, completely blown away and paralyzed by fear, absolutely terrified. Now, it says here, and this I hope you'll, and I'll probably do this a little slower because I want to make sure I get this incredibly powerful play on words with David across, because it's all a bit lost in the English, but it's all there in the Hebrew. When it says of Goliath, he uses this word defy. He defied them. It's in verse 10, verse 25, verse 36, and verse 45. But the Hebrew word is a lot more than defy. The Hebrew word literally means to strip off, to strip naked, to expose, right? And that's where we get this sense of defaming them, shaming them, stripping them naked, just like stripping them of any semblance of courage, but also exposing them, defaming them, shaming them. It's actually translated elsewhere, like in Isaiah 65, verse 7, to blaspheme. And that probably gives us an insight, because obviously 40 days and 40 nights, we don't have everything Goliath said, but a lot of it was blasphemy, blasphemy against God, which is how David says it, how he interprets this. So look at that. They saw, the men of Israel saw, David heard, and he didn't like what he hears. So verse 26, what shall be done for the man who kills this Philistine, and look at this, takes away the reproach from Israel. What do you think the Hebrew for takes away is? Literally, it means turns off, to turn off. Like you, in the old days, a radio, turn off. David's saying, I do not like the sound of this fellow. I want to turn him off. I want to turn that blasphemy right off by lopping his head off. It's really profound. You are seeking to expose us. I'm going to turn you off. It's not a bad little message today when there's such a constant stream of so many things that take our attention, much of which can be quite blasphemous. Now, he says, take away or turn off the reproach. What's the word reproach? The disgrace. This man is disgracing us. I'm going to turn it off. He wanted to turn the tables. That's what he does. I want to flip the tables here. Turn it right back around on this fellow who's seeking to expose us. The dialogue continues. Verse 26. Who is this uncircumcised Philistine? Why does he use that word? I reckon you're right there immediately. Every male would be. What does the word uncircumcised literally mean? It means to expose, obviously, to expose, to remove the foreskin, to expose, right? So the word uncircumcised literally means to expose. You're trying to expose us. I'm going to expose you. And you are exposing yourself, you uncircumcised, you vile, he calls him later, you vile Philistine. And it gets even better. The root word for uncircumcised literally is the word to strip. You're trying to strip us, defame us. You're the one that's going to be stripped for everyone to see who you are, and I'm going to be the one to do that for you. Now, David's bravery reaches Saul, and we see in verse 32 the interaction between David and Saul. David says to Saul, let no man's heart fail because of him. Your servant will go and fight. The word fail, what do you think that is? It literally is the exact same Hebrew word used to the men of Israel when they fell prostrate. David's saying, we got to stand up. Everyone's falling down. We can't have that. I'm going to turn the tables. We're going to turn this around. None of us should fall down. We're going to make a stand this day. Very powerful message to us in this modern era as well, that where the occasion calls for it, we similarly take our stand. We don't bow down like Daniel and his three friends. But Saul makes the same mistake as David. He, like us as humans, looked on the outward appearance. And he looks at David and he's like, you're but a youth. That's what he says in verse 33. You're not able to go to this Philistine to fight with him, for you are but a youth and he's a man of war from his youth. So same mistake of Samuel. Looking on the external, you're just a young lad, a shepherd boy. You're standing here with a staff and a sling. What good is you? Is Saul, because he looked on the outward, not the heart of this incredibly courageous young man. As David says, hey, I've killed lions and bears. I've rescued my lambs out of their mouths. But what does he say? He doesn't necessarily say, I did it. Look at what he says, verse 37. The Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion and from the paw of the bear, he will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine. It's not about me, David's saying. God will do this, just as he did with the lion and the bear. I'm up for it because God will work through me. And what did David see? They all saw the Philistine, Goliath. What does he see? He sees, as he said, the living God. Now, just as an aside here, you've probably thought of this before. What was the distinguishing quality of Saul? You would remember Saul was the tallest person in the land. In fact, he was so shy because he was this tall guy who poked up above everyone. So just think in passing, David's no waif, because with all due respect, Zoe, I suspect if you stood before Saul, being Dars, he probably wouldn't say, take my armour and put it on, because it would be obvious it just wouldn't fit. So David was clearly a pretty impressive young man for Saul, being so tall, to say, hey, go and wear my armour. But David's like, no, God is going to have this victory. I'm going to put on the armor of God. I don't need the armor of man. I will go and the victory will be God's. Incredible. I mean, these are not pop-up storybooks that we read to our kids. This really happened. We've got to believe that. Amazing courage to run down into this gorge or to pick our way down, as we'll see, with just his staff and his sling. Now, have a look in verse 39. It says then that David put off the armor. And that's exactly this same word, turn off, again. It occurs again. He put it off. I'm going to turn this Philistine off, but I'm not going to do it with the armor of men. So then verse 40, here it is. He took his staff in his hand. He chose 5 smooth stones from the brook. He put them in his shepherd's pouch. His sling was in his hand, and he approached the Philistine. So before this, we can just imagine the scene, this lone figure pecking his way down the side of the gorge all the way down to the valley floor, to the little brook. You can imagine all the Israelites peering over with fear and trepidation, a bit incredulous. Who is this guy? He's mad. He's crazy. This little guy, look at him against this massive guy. I mean, he doesn't even have any armor. You can imagine the chatter going around. They would have been dumbfounded, all peering over. And then similarly, the Philistines would have been looking over with eager anticipation. This is going to be good. Check this out. Like, you know, unfair, but let's check this out. This is going to be fun to watch. So you can imagine all the reaction, the derision probably, the Philistines would have been calling out, the gasps of the Israelites as one of their own pecked his way down the side of that steep ravine. We read that he stoops and picks the 5 stones. The word choose is to try. So this is not David's first rodeo. He chose, like, you know, young kids or older kids skimming rocks. He picked the right rocks for his sling. He knew what he was doing. God worked through the skill and dexterity of David. So he picks these rocks and moves forward and confronts this fierce man, Goliath. And what David says to David that obviously cuts through the silence is really quite disgusting. And I do ask you to excuse me a little bit for unpacking the Hebrew here, but it's important that we get a sense of what Goliath was actually implying. It says in verse 42, when the Philistine looked and saw David was but a youth, ruddy and handsome in appearance, the Philistine said to David, am I a dog that you come to me with sticks? And the Philistine cursed David. Now, you may never have had cause to look into those words more specifically, but I'll just give you enough to give you a feel of what Goliath's really saying. When it says that he looked, it's actually quite an intriguing Hebrew word. It means to look at intently, but to regard with pleasure and expectation. And note that he recognized he was a youth and ruddy and handsome in appearance. He noticed all that. And when we learn that the word dog, both in the Bible and certainly outside of the Bible, and for quite some time historically, was used as a euphemism for a male prostitute, we get some idea of what Goliath was actually saying to David when this young man came out to him, what he was implying that he would do to him. It's really quite disgusting. I won't go into all the detail, but it's vile. And that's why when it says the Philistine cursed David, that word is translated elsewhere to be vile. It literally has that meaning of being vile, repulsive, or disgusting. As we already have seen, this man stood for the filth of the flesh, and he sees this very handsome young man, and he says, I am going to do this to you. You are insulting me. I'm going to to you sort of thing. And it's really quite foul. David's response, unbelievable. Verse 46, the Lord will deliver you into my hand. I will strike you down and cut off your head. Yeah, the word deliver literally in the Hebrew is the word shut up. It's in the Bible. Shut up. I am going to shut you up. I'm going to turn you off is the impression, the word David's saying. I will shut you up. When it says cut off, what does that mean? Here it is again. It's the word, the Hebrew word often rendered, turn off. I'm going to shut you up. I'm going to turn you off. And the way I'm going to do it is I'm going to cut your head off. It's all about what he heard, this vile, contemptuous blasphemy. I'm going to turn it off. I'm going to shut it up. And I'm going to do it by taking your head off. Verse 39, the impact of all of this, Goliath fell on his face to the ground. And verse 51, when the Philistines saw their champion was dead, they fled. The word fall, identical to heart fail. Fled, identical to the word we looked at earlier, which we saw was the Hebrew word vanish, which was the word fled in verse 24. So David succeeded. He turned the tables. Before, it was them falling down. Before, it was them vanishing. Now, all the Philistines fell down and all the Philistines vanished. Totally turned the tables on this whole very poignant situation. And then verse 53, the people of Israel came back from chasing the Philistines. And the word chasing literally means a flame. David lit a flame, a burning passion, belief, confidence replaced fear, a terrified people. David lit them up. And that's what exactly today, an act of courage from any of us here today in a very, very difficult, blasphemous world, an act of courage, steadfastness, faith from any of us can have just the same impact today. It can inspire others, give us belief to go on and endure. So in closing, I said I wouldn't overly spiritualize it, but there is, to me, probably the most iconic passage that comes to mind in terms of the battle we fight today. Who are the giants that we fight today? Often they're the giants of philosophy, the giants of the podcast who put out the seemingly compelling arguments to belittle faith, belittle Christianity. The Bible predicted that. 2 Corinthians 10, verse 3. Though we walk in the flesh, we are not waging war according to the flesh, for the weapons of our warfare are not of the flesh, but have divine power to destroy strongholds. And look at this. We destroy not Goliaths. Who are the Goliaths of today? The Goliaths of today are this. We destroy arguments and every lofty opinion raised against the knowledge of God. That's the Goliaths, I think, that we fight against today. And we've got to be as up for it, as courageous as David was back in that incredible incident in that gorge in the Valley of Elah.